Welcome to the Top Gear Magazine podcast, a peek behind the curtain of what it's really like to drive other people's cars for a living. These are the stories behind the stories. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Top Gear Magazine podcast. I am Jack Ricks, editor of Top Gear Magazine, a.k.a. the Grand Fromage, and I'm joined today by...
Ollie Q, the baby bell, the deputy editor of Top Gear Magazine. We've got the sheriff and the deputy in today.
Exactly. It's just the two of us feeling a bit sort of exposed. We've been abandoned by Ollie Marriage and Rowan Horncastle, who are elsewhere in the world.
Driving a wide variety of extremely fast cars.
Well, Rowan's in China. I'm not sure he's driving any particularly fast cars.
I think he's seeing the future, isn't he? We're all led to believe that the Chinese are on the way, or he's gone to see what they're bringing.
Yeah, and Ollie's behind the wheel of a Porsche race car.
So. Yeah, he's setting himself up for a drive at Le Mans, I think, 2024. Mm-hmm. It's the year of Ollie Marriage on the podium. So good luck, Ollie. Go well.
Right, so, but I think it's quite fitting because this is a big podcast because it's the Top Gear Awards issue.
I really hope they put some echo and reverb on that.
I know, I tried to give it some gravitas. Yeah. Did it come through?
Awards.
Issue.
It's a big deal.
It is a big deal. And look, it's a big moment. We normally, when we go live with an issue podcast, we do it a week after it's on sale. We give you a chance to get out to the shops, read your mags, absorb the content, and then hear some of the stories behind the stories from us guys in the studio. But this time we're dropping it right on the 29th of November. So if you're listening to this podcast the moment it goes live, which I very much hope you are because you're a subscriber.
You've dropped everything.
You've dropped everything. You've just walked out of
the
office.
Get the kids, leave them.
To sit on the curb outside and listen to this podcast. I think it's important that you do that. We're dropping everything at once. So the big awards moment. If I'm talking to my future self, I probably have a hangover because on the 28th of November, we have our physical award ceremony where we hand out the trophies to all the worthy winners in our awards issue. But today, all the winners are live on topgear.com. You can read loads more information about all of them. The magazine is on the shelves and you need to pick up a physical copy of this because it comes with your bonus 2024 supercar calendar. I know you've got one on your bedroom wall.
Wit woo. Yeah. Who's Miss April?
I love it. Whenever I go to see my parents, my dad, who is a subscriber, shout out to dad, he does proudly hang his Top Gear supercar calendar on the wall in his study. A passing interest in cars, but out of solidarity with his son.
Oh, you get yours is on the study. That's interesting because Q Senior hangs his on the garage wall.
Nice.
Which is, so every time he's in there fetching some tools for me to borrow, he can have a look at the calendar. Lovely.
Oh, good. Nice skills. What else can you do with the awards? Oh, yes, we've shot a video. So if you go to Top Gear's YouTube channel, there's a walk around video. We do it every year. So we get as many of the winners as we possibly can in one place, in a studio. That's to shoot the incredible cover image for the magazine.
It's a corker this year, isn't it?
Yeah.
Lightsabers.
It's an absolute belter. But also we shoot a walk around and tell you a bit more about who's won, what's won, throw in some video clips for stuff we've shot across the year. So make sure you check out that video. Basically, what I'm trying to say is it's an awards smorgasbord. A smorgasbord of ways to consume the Top Gear Awards, and there's also this podcast which you're listening to, so you're probably aware of that.
This is the result of a lot of arguments, basically, isn't it? When we start thrashing these out, it can get, the WhatsApps can get pretty heated at times. But I think we've come up with a strong list of award contenders. We should probably get into who's been crowned. Have they been crowned?
Crowned.
Who's they been have tiara'd? Been,
they've been crowned, they've been named, they've been selected, they've been picked, they've been...
Appraised.
Yes. So, very simple format. We're just going to go through the award winners. We've got a copy of the magazine in front of us. In fact, we don't even have a copy of the magazine. We have a digital page-turner version, which is top secret, because the mag is probably being printed as we speak.
Yeah, and there's some things in it that we aren't allowed to give to the public right now, but we will be able to when this has come out. It's all quite confusing, isn't it?
It is a bit confusing. We basically live our lives in the past, present and future simultaneously with embargoes flying around our heads. So the first award is Disruptor of the Year, and it goes to the Tesla Cybertruck. Now, Ollie, I cannot tell you anything about this car.
Well, this is immediately ridiculous. I'm looking at a photo of you giving the V for Victory sign out of the driver's window of a Tesla Cybertruck, meaning you are one of the very few people in the world I can speak to right now outside of Tesla who's driven this F-117 stealth bomber on wheels.
Yeah.
And yet you're not allowed to talk about it. Please explain why.
Well, because there's a very, very complicated split embargo, which means, I can reveal that we went out to Los Angeles and had a go in the Cybertruck. And more than that, we spoke to the head of design and the head of engineering and got the full story behind this car that is, you know, less of a vehicle, more of a triple A-list celebrity. Mm. But Tesla has given us the blessing to run the story, the full story in Top Gear magazine on sale now. So if you're quick and you can get to the shops and buy yourself a physical copy of the magazine, you will be able to read the full Cybertruck story for the next 2 days. And then on December the 1st, 11 a.m. GMT, that's when the embargo breaks and you'll be able to watch our Cybertruck video on YouTube. There'll be a full make model review of the car on topgear.com. But until that time, because you could potentially be listening to this on the 29th of November, I cannot tell you anything about the car.
But we should get into the fact that the Cybertruck's been late, it's been delayed, and a lot of people are still going to think, oh, so what did you drive? Probably some prototype, probably some kind of concept version. You did drive, I'm right in saying, a proper production one.
Right? I feel like a car exec now, that you're basically going to poke and probe until I give up some sort of leaked information. Yes, it is a production.
I'm going to give you a journalistic prostate exam.
It's a... It was a production Cybertruck.
Yeah.
It was a production Cybertruck, and that's as much as I'm giving you right now.
Shining the bright light in his eyes right now, listeners.
But I'm going to end up in a prison in Elon's basement.
Is ridiculous. But Elon Musk, the king of going on podcasts and running his mouth and saying things that he probably shouldn't.
Also,
we're not allowed to talk about his pickup
truck. Also, one of the most photographed, must be the most photographed car for its development journey.
You know,
it leaves the factory gates. There's paparazzi everywhere. I mean, everyone's paparazzi these days with their phones.
Going, oh my God, that's Jack Ricks. Quick, call TMZ.
Exactly. So let's leave it there because I will slip up very soon. But we wanted to make you aware of that story. Moving on, Manufacturer of the Year. Who won this one, Ollie?
Well, this is an up-and-coming car company doing a lot for the greater good. This is Lamborghini. How on earth can Top Gear justify giving Lamborghini Manufacturer of the Year? Well, if you actually break it down and go, who's had the most hits, who's got the most momentum, Lambo are on a heck of a roll right now, and not just in producing big, loud supercars, which you'd think would be their sort of bread and butter. I mean, yes, the Revuelto's come out and been a huge step on from the Aventador, but we've been blown away this year by the Huracan Sturato, which is a kind of a different take on a supercar, an off-roading V10. And then, of course, you've been up close and personal with where they're going next SUV-wise.
Yeah, which is called the Lanzador concept. So they reveal that at Car Week over in the States in the summer. It's basically a sort of supercar on stilts. That's what they want us to think anyway. So it's a four-door, very low roofline, coupe-ish SUV that's pure electric.
Looks so much better than the Urus, which really is a kind of hunched-over Touareg. Yeah. But it's like, imagine if you were the boss of Lamborghini and you had to deliver like the end-of-year presentation to like the shareholders and the big bosses, and you're sort of a bit nervous, you know, tugging at your collar going in thinking, whoa, have I got enough on my side? Imagine just standing up in front of everyone and going, hello, thanks for coming. Sit down, questions at the end. Revuelto.
Stop eating at the back.
Exactly. Revuelto, the big Fandango, sold out for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Sturato, was a silly after-hours project that's turned into, I think they've made like 1,200 of those. That's invented a new genre of supercar.
He probably at that point mentioned that it got to the final three in Top Gear Speed Week.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that would be high on the agenda, I think.
And the shareholders are going, why didn't it win? He's going, don't worry about that. We've got a new electric crossover coming, which looks way better than our current SUV, although even that itself is printing money. What was that stat you told me earlier about how many cars Lamborghini are selling at the minute?
So they've sold, this is another one of the reasons they're manufacturer of the year. So they've sold over 5,000 in the first 6 months of 2023. So 5,300 or 400 cars.
5,000 Lamborghinis in the first half of the year. at a time when the Aventador has basically gone out of production and they're ramping up Revuelto, mm-hmm. and the Huracan is ancient. Yeah. So that's basically Urus doing the heavy lifting. So I just looked this up. So 5,000 cars, first half of the year. Do you know how many Aventadors they sold in total in like 12 years?
A few thousand.
11,000. And that's a big selling supercar. So they're just absolutely raking it in. And then with that money, they're going racing, which is the one kind of hole in Lamborghini's repertoire. They've now decided, yeah, these Le Mans regs look a bit tasty and Ferrari just won it. Wouldn't it be fun to give them a bit of a bloody nose? So they're off to Le Mans with a hypercar covered in triangles.
It's going to be fun cheering on a Lamborghini around around the track at Le Mans, isn't it? Because it's just easy to like. Look, there's the Lambo! Woohoo!
I wouldn't put it past them to just give it, like, you know, a ridiculous, like, straight-through exhaust that makes it no faster, but just shoots loads of fire, just because it'll be a fan favourite.
What's this extra wing on top of the other?
Yeah.
This just looks...
makes it 10 mile an hour slower down the straights, but look at it.
But it's not an easy time to be a supercar maker because, you know, as you see, they're trying to make this transition from big, shouty petrol engines to plug-in hybrid engines to eventually, as they've shown, in 5 years' time, they're going to have a pure electric car. So it's really difficult. And the Sterato is them going, you can't just keep adding more power, more speed ad infinitum. It has to end somewhere. So here's a different direction. Maybe you can take all the noise and excitement and drama and take it off-road and skid about a bit. And I love that. So they're having to diversify. But then equally with the Revuelto, they've kept the naturally aspirated V12.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting next year because they'll be replacing the Huracan, and we still don't know what engine's going to be in the back of it. Rumours suggest V8 twin turbo, plug-in hybrid.
That, but also could they have possibly saved the V10 and done something clever with cylinder deactivation or something? I've heard different things, but it just seems to be they're a company that's not currently wrestling. Mm. Everyone else is wrestling with, oh God, electrification and autonomy and goodness knows what else. And Lamborghini just seems to be having the time of their lives.
Yeah.
And considering that, you know, it wasn't honestly that long ago that they were on these car companies that kind of lurched from crisis to crisis and every now and again added some more slats to an air intake. And now they're really going after folks. And you've got to think, like, you know, Ferrari SF90 not been our favourite kind of 1,000 horsepower supercar as things go. And then Lamborghini sort of done the dirty on them, the Revuelto. Looks better, sounds better. So, yeah, that's why Lamborghini, not Hyundai, not Ford, not the manufacturer of the year, the best car company in 2023. Well done, Lambo.
And I should say a lot of thought went into that because, as we joked about at the start, manufacturer of the year does tend to be someone a bit more worthy, someone that's brought good-looking cars or affordable cars or something to the masses, you know, because it's a lot harder to build a very good £20,000 car than a very good £250,000 supercar. But as we've, for all the reasons above, we feel like Lamborghini's sort of pushed the envelope this year. So well done them. Next up.
Next up is a headline.
Headline of the year goes to...
Well, it's been a funny old year for electric cars. Here are these for bookends. The bargain of the year, the Dacia Spring, a electric, super cheap electric city car coming over to these shores in 2024. And then our luxury car of the year. And this is interesting because it's not our electric luxury car. It's not our electric anything. It's just the luxury car of the year, full stop, the Rolls Royce Spectre. So we've got a car called Spring and we've got a car called Rolls. Any listeners care to hazard a guess what the headline for the feature might be? And I'm going to blush behind the microphone. Spring Rolls. I thought you were going to say it. I was teeing you up.
No, I'm not going to.
Yeah, I had a big, big sigh of relief reading this feature because it was written by none other than the Top Gear Oracle, Big Brain himself, Paul Horrell. And up until he took the Dacia Spring and the Rolls-Royce Spectre out for an adventure together, I was the only person at Top Gear who'd driven the Rolls Spectre, and I was blown away by it. I thought it was so magnificent. And then the doubt started to creep in.
Car journalist imposter syndrome, where you go, did I call that one terribly?
Especially was I jet-lagged? Was it actually terrible?
Made worse by the fact that when you have to film a video on the launch, so you're first person behind the wheel, you know, an hour or two to get to a location, and suddenly the in-car camera is looking at you, and it's like, go on then,
deliver your verdict. This is amazing.
I'm really enjoying it, but you know, obviously you got to back yourself. You're a pro, Ollie. You nailed it. I think
the Spectre though is standout.
Yeah, yeah.
I said this is not just, you know, the best luxury car. This is probably the greatest Rolls Royce of all time. It's magnificent. But what I loved about this is it shows, yeah, the breadth of stuff you can do with electric. Electric makes city cars brilliant, and it makes Rolls Royce about as good as they've ever been.
I should point out, actually, an interesting sort of nuance between, this is the main awards, if you want, the Top Gear Awards that always comes just before Christmas at the end of the year. But we also have our EV awards in the spring every year. And one of the decisions we made a few years ago, to be very clear about, was that there would be no best small EV of the year or best luxury EV of the year. No defined EV categories in the main awards. If an electric car was simply better than its combustion engine rivals at doing a certain job, then it wins an award. Mm. So when you go through, you'll see, yeah, bargain of the year. It's not the bargain EV of the year, and it's not the luxury EV. I just wanted to make that clear.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's a worthwhile distinction making, and it's sort of heartening that the bookends of the car world are in such rude health.
Yeah.
And we can all fantasize about a Spectre, but knowing that this little Dacia that's coming along next year, you know, it's going to have this sort of slightly roughy tufty look to it, big up arches, and even, you know, Paul himself said it's not super comfortable, it's not loaded with all equipment, but you can plug your phone in and that works, and it takes speed bumps in its stride. But it's just about getting people who otherwise wouldn't be able to get into an EV into this kind of motoring.
And what Dacia does better than anyone is not just produce cheap cars and then you get in it and you sort of cringe as the door closes and you touch the tacky steering wheel and you go, what have I done? I've bought an absolute shonky piece of tat here. That it sort of celebrates its cheapness. So the suspension is very loose, lots of body roll.
There's an inverse snobbery to that, isn't it? It's just like,
but also
got a whole car.
Ollie Marriage, when he drove it, he said it feels like the modern incarnation of the 2CV, because it's that sort of cheapness and simplicity is all part of its character, and that's what makes it fun. It's not very fast. I think the fast one does 0-60 in 14 seconds.
That's the fast one. But the slow one doesn't do 0-60.
They're still measuring it. Okay, so next up, hypercar of the year, and it's the GMA T50. It's the Gordon Murray T50. What else could it be?
The interesting car that Ollie Marriage said is the greatest hypercar of all time. So it kind of had to go home with a pot, didn't it?
But I think an interesting point here, and Ollie, in his article in the magazine, picks this up in his intro, is it a hypercar at all? Mm. Because, I mean, what is a hypercar? A hypercar is partly defined by its price, you know. So these days, it's sort of £2-2.5 million kind of entry ticket. But it's also, you know, outrageous amounts of power. They tend to be styled very flamboyantly. There's these kind of touch points that elevate it above sort of cooking supercars, if you like. Whereas the T50 goes about everything differently. You know, everything is channeled towards making it a better driving experience for the person who's driving it. And if it doesn't, it's superfluous to requirements. That's why it weighs less than a ton.
Yeah, and that's why it's quite literally eye-watering, isn't it? If you haven't seen it already, get yourself off to YouTube, pause the pod, and go and check out our world-exclusive drive of it. I'd say a drive is a bit of an understatement. A 900-mile road trip through town, on motorways, and then best of all, up in the mountains in Spain, Ollie Marriage having the time of his life, having a motoring epiphany and delivering an absolutely gorgeous film while never missing a gear shift with 12,000 RPM.
Well, not in the final edit.
Not on camera,
in the final edit.
No, fair play to Ollie. It's an absolutely lovely film, already going down a storm on YouTube, and I have to say, I've already watched it a couple of times, just for the opening sequence, which someone in the comments said Christopher Nolan would have been proud of that. That's high praise.
There is an intro to that video, which, you know, praise must go to the videographers who put in so much work with the edit on that. I get chills just thinking about it. The first 30 seconds,
yeah,
oh My
it's
word.
Like a, it's like the start opening of a Bond film. It's just the soaring music, this incredible scenery, and then you just hear this shriek and go, could that possibly be coming from a car? No, it's coming from Ollie Marriage. But it's a lovely, lovely
Ollie
film.
Ollie Marriage at 12,000 RPM.
Yes.
I love it. I love it.
So, anyway, in fact, if you get the mag, then you can, thanks to the wonders of technology, just hover your phone camera over the QR code that's right next to the T50 page, and it will take you straight to that film.
There we go. Don't let it be said we're not high tech. QR codes.
If you'd ring
They've up only the... been around for about 15 years.
Yeah. Ring up the telephone exchange and they'll connect you to YouTube.
Right, so next up, all the car you'll ever need, BMW M3 Touring.
It's what we started the year with, really. It was one of the first pods in the year. It was the first big trip I did this year, was taking the M3 Touring to Switzerland, to the Grand St. Bernard Pass, which was closed. But the hospice where they breed the official St. Bernard Rescue Dogs was very much open, and they were only too happy to test out the dog carrying capabilities of BMW's first M3 Touring by putting two fully grown St. Bernards in the back. And well, somewhere out there, there's an M3 Touring with a heck of a lot of slobber in it. And it's not just mine, because I love that car, but it wasn't me drooling in the boot. I was drooling in the driver's seats.
I've actually, the photo we've got in the mag is the boot open and one of these enormous St. Bernards.
That's like Tyrannosaurus Rex.
At the back. I said to Ollie, well done. You seem to have found maybe a Great Dane being the other breed. The only breed of dog that actually doesn't fit in the back of the M3 Touring.
I know, yeah.
You must have been shoehorning it in. Like,
we haven't had a call from the RSPCA yet. No. Now, all animal, you know, anti-cruelty measures were followed. The dog was, we had trouble getting him out because he fell asleep in there. Yeah. But it was, that got off the year off to a good start. It is the car that we've been waiting for ages. And our praise and everyone else's must have gone down all right, because big news from BMW this year is there's an M5 Touring coming. So they've decided that fast wagons, there's life left in them yet, and that's music to our ears.
Yeah, we've actually got the boss of BMW M, Frank Van Meel, coming to our awards event, which is, well, as we record this, in about a week's time.
Yeah, we've told him it's for the XM, and then when he gets up on stage, we're all going to throw tomatoes at him.
But actually, yeah, it's really interesting because... yes, he's brought back the M3 Touring. Yes, he's bringing back M5 Touring. High praise. Why has it taken so long? But equally, there's, new M2, good car, manual gearbox. You know,
but not perfect.
Not perfect, not perfect. But as a type of car for BMW to be making new,
yes,
you know, that requires some credit.
But this comes back to what we were saying about Lamborghini having like a super strong year. Like the M division has not had like a golden year. Like XM's absolutely dreadful. The it just is the worst car of the year. The M2, yeah, if you know, great if you get one with the standard seats, but if you put the carbon seats in it and then try and hit the clutch pedal, you'll give yourself a career-ending hip injury. So it's not been a home run, but then that's why rising above that, the M3 Touring does seem to hit so many bases for so many people so much of the time, and that's why it's the Top Gear, all the car you'll ever need for this year.
It's interesting how the human brain has an ability to filter out the bad memories and remember the good ones.
My left leg's still chafing from driving the M2.
It's why when I look back at my two children, you know, the first 6 years, you know, I quite like them still. And I seem to have filtered out all the times that they've yelled at me, thrown stuff at me and not done what I've asked them
rubbed
to do.
Food into the seats of expensive press cars.
But yeah, 2023 will be the year of the M3 Touring, and we won't be
worried. We'll forget all about the XM.
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Right, so design of the year.
Talking of SUVs, but ones that don't look like a war wound.
Well, I was going to tee this up by saying design of the year, what is it? An Alfa, a limited run Alfa Romeo supercar.
Yes, the Stradale.
Yeah, some sort of Zagato coach built special. A Ferrari, is it?
Something sensuous.
Something,
and all these kind of
curvaceous,
words that designers
voluptuous.
Use.
It's
a different magazine you're talking about.
Sorry. Back to the point. I mean, none of those words apply to this car, but it's really good looking.
Yeah.
And we all sort of... It's funny when a good looking car comes along and everyone... The consensus is sort of universal quite quickly. So it's like, ooh, that looks good.
The car in question, listeners, to put you at your ease, is the new Toyota Land Cruiser. What it had was the element of surprise, because Toyota has come from being, you know, sort of dishwasher in chief a few years ago to sort of, you know, finding the mojo. And it did that with the GR Supra, the GR Yaris, and the GR86. And that kind of got us the you know, tyre killers on side. But what they still didn't have, I'd argue, was great design. They weren't doing that sort of Hyundai thing of going like, flipping heck, they're making better looking cars than the Germans, the French and the British now. But now, this Land Cruiser it's got that chunky Tonka toy sort of better looking Hummer execution all over it. And it's bringing squares back.
But it's got some lovely sort of retro flourishes to it. And I feel that just softens it. It sort of tugs on your heartstrings. Ooh, do your nostalgic
buttons. Your headlight anecdote, because I love this.
Oh, yeah. So, again, excuse if I've got the exact details wrong on this, but I believe if you want the round retro headlights, which, to be honest, bring the whole design together.
Yeah, that sets it off to a tick.
Sets it off. You have to get I think it's the top two trim levels. On the lower trim levels, you get square headlights, which is a hell of an upsell, isn't it? You're just like, oh, that new Land Cruiser, it looks fantastic. Yeah, you have to get the high-spec one if you want it to look like
that. If you want to set off the design just right. In the same way as everyone used to say, like Chris Bangle, when he was at BMW and designed all the weird-looking ones. Yeah. He designed them all for the M Sport kits and the massive wheels, and that's why when you just saw someone who had gone, I'm all right with the SE, thanks, that's why it looked a bit dowdy, whereas Toyota have gone, right, you have to go retro with it. And the one that we've shot in the mag, which looks tremendous, is in a kind of mustard yellow with a white roof, dark trim around the sort of the plimsoll line, if you like, you know, where it's going to get bashed off road. And that is the spec.
That's the color to have it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. If you had said, oh, what color do you want your new Land Cruiser in? Mustard. Yeah. Colonel Mustard, please.
The Colonel. Colonel Mustard in the Toyota dealership.
But it is absolutely spot on. Right, track car of the year. I mean, there's only one.
Yeah, we can almost skip past it, which is no denigration to the work of the Porsche GT department, but we spent plenty of time telling everyone who'll listen and plenty who won't that the GT3 RS is the best road legal car you can drive on a track this year, and quite possibly of any other. Yeah. It absolutely blew my mind at Speed Week. The confidence, the difference between how intimidating it is when you walk up to it to how friendly it is, how it encourages you to never brake, is quite extraordinary. Yeah. And I think it's an absolute masterpiece.
Yeah, so we waxed lyrical about that car on our two-part Speed Week podcast when we went out to Sweden and drove all the year's, the best performance cars launched in the last 12 months. So go and listen to those podcasts, and we deep dive into what makes the 911 GT3 RS so spectacular.
Do you know what's really bonkers about that, though? It's not even the best 911 this year. 911 ST.
Oh,
not a track car, but that's even better. But we'll come back to that another day.
I know, because... but even that I'm jumping ahead a bit, doesn't win a TopGear.com award. That's how exclusive it is to get your hands on one of these gongs.
Yeah, you can build your best sports car for 60 years and still not win a medal. Unlucky, Porsche.
Exactly.
Come on, Andreas Preuninger. Right. Pull your finger out.
GT of the year.
Yeah.
It feels right to have an Aston Martin in this category.
It does. Isn't it funny that GT of the year kind of still exists? Because I know, like, now everyone's making Bentley, and everyone makes SUVs, Rolls-Royce and Aston Martin. You kind of assume that that does the GT job. But no, there's life in the big front-engine coupe yet, and the DB12 is Aston Martin's answer to the question, what would a DB11 be like if you spent some money making it better? And they have, and it is. I've not actually even sat in one yet, but the way that Ollie came back going, they've sorted that.
Yeah.
That drives better. Yeah. It's got an interior you can actually get along with without needing sort of marriage counselling. It sounds like they've done a number on it, and it's nice to hear that the GT tradition, as you say, Aston Martin, it feels only right that they should have a car in that space.
Quite right.
And it shouldn't just leave Bentley. The Bentley Continental GT is a piece of magnificence, but it shouldn't have the whole market to itself. Yeah. It should have an upstart with a better sounding engine breathing down its neck, and Aston Martin have delivered that.
Quite. And there's a feeling with Aston Martin sometimes that they're sort of getting a bit ahead of themselves. You know, when they showed us Valkyrie and Valhalla and the Vanquish, which they've now canned, that was going to be the sort of Ferrari, I was going to say 488, 296 rival. Mm. And then they were like, oh, let's launch the Lagonda brand as some uber luxury EV thing, and let's do this and that and that, and let's build a tower block in Miami, and let's and you just sort of thought, calm
just
down.
They floated their share price. How interesting. Yeah, but we'll not
get there. Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was an Aston Martin submarine.
Yeah, and like a vertical takeoff aircraft.
Oh.
Remember that?
Yes.
Not making that up. If you Google like Aston Martin sort of plane commuter jetpack thing, there's a rendering.
I may have pitched for the world exclusive flight and that, and never got a reply to that email. Mainly because it doesn't exist.
Yeah,
but look, if you're going to do all these brand extensions and, you know, plow new furrows, you need to make the heartland cars right. Now that the DB12 is there, it feels like the groundwork's in place for Aston Martin to go places.
Yeah.
Another headline of the year.
And I cannot take any credit for this, because this came from Top Gear's glorious art department, the team who design the magazine and bring you the stunning covers and, you know, the pictures that grace our calendar and everything else. Sometimes when they're just they get the pictures in and they think, oh, we'll just pop a headline in there just to see how it looks and we can change it later. I couldn't top it. The Top Gear family car of the year is the Kia EV9, or according to the art department, the family unit. Nice. Because it is an absolute unit. It's a filing cabinet on wheels.
Yeah, and where did you take it?
Took it to Ibiza, mate. That's where I tend to autumn. That's where I go in the fall.
I just got this image of you sort of rocking up, going, I'm here, baby! And everyone just baby. Everyone's gone home. Yeah. There's just no parties.
But this is what was fascinating about going to Ibiza out of season, is I did expect it to be an absolute ghost town, but it's not. It's heaving. I was thinking, we'll be able to drive this great big 3-row 7-seat SUV anywhere we want with gay abandon and just park it up next to yachts and marinas and on posh driveways. And no, it'd be throughout the season. They keep the party going, but for just a different audience, for people who aren't, you know, shot-taking enthusiasts. So, well, the idea of this was Ibiza, the whole island, has been trying to go green and go up market at the same time, which is kind of a tricky thing to pull off. But basically, they've decided we're fed up with being known as just the kind of vomiting into bikinis capital of the Balearic Sea, and we want to be a place of sustainable tourism. So they're trying to ban bottled water and capture all their rainwater, so any water you drink on Ibiza will have fallen there from the clouds. They're trying to eradicate plastic waste. I know a lot of places are trying to do this, but they're really trying to use Ibiza as like a bit of a case study. And if Ibiza can pull it off, then they can implement those policies on the Spanish mainland. So it's quite a clever idea. And it's a way of driving tourism, because people want to go on holiday, but they want to do so in a more guilt-free way. So that's Ibiza's plan, and they've been trying to, you know, build more sustainable hotels and so on and so forth. And I was thinking, going green, going up market, what does that remind me of? Ah, yes, a £75,000 Kia with getting on for 400 brake horsepower, the same dimensions as a Range Rover, but, you know, still undercutting its premium competition. That is the EV9's raison d'etre, if you like. That is, you know, its job is to do what a Range Rover or a Range Rover Sport does, you know, transport 6 or 7 people in enormous comfort with huge amounts of technology, but do it for a considerable amount less. I mean, they're charging 75 grand for the one that we drove. It's going to start at 65 when the base model comes next year. But what do Volvo want for that new EX90, another all-electric 3-row SUV? Yeah. So that was the idea, was take it to Ibiza to kind of harmoniously tell those two stories and just spend a bit of time in the EV9, which I'm slightly worried won't fit in England, because it is, as I say, an absolute unit. It is enormous. Might work us slightly better in California.
Same, but same dimensions as a Range Rover, you say?
It's like 5 meters long and 2 meters, over 5 meters long and 2 meters wide.
I mean, Range Rovers might not necessarily fit, but that hasn't stopped absolutely everyone buying one in
Indeed.
London.
And you might be able to insure this as well, so that helps. But what's interesting is you're thinking, okay, how's that going green? It's a big electric car. It's probably got half a ton of lithium and copper in it. And that is true. But it's what's above that that's the green angle. So what they've tried to do is do this very, very clever interior, which uses nothing. Everything's recycled in there, basically. Yeah. So we've seen before floor mats made of fishing nets. It's got those. But it's got a bio polyurethane seats in it, and you think, well, that sounds horrible, but it's a very, very convincing leather substitute. But it's all made from recycled plastic, so it doesn't use new oil-based plastic pellets. The stuffing in the seats is made from cornstarch and sawdust. There's the paint on the trim. The paint itself has been formulated so it doesn't come with all those things ending in as a PABA theme. You know when you read the contents of a bleach bottle and you go, oh, I don't like the idea of that.
Yeah.
It's all formulated to be sharing, caring, clean and green. And I know that sounds like a lot of PR, but it's like...
It's like you swallowed the press release.
No, I know, but I don't want it to come across like that, because you do have to critique this stuff. And as I put to some of the people from Kia, the thing is, like, even the car companies that do use lots of wood and leather and all this sort of hearty stuff in the car, it's not, you know, Bentley are always at pains to point out that, and Rolls-Royce as well, actually, I should say, that their leather comes from cows which have already been earmarked for slaughter for meat, so that the skins, the hides are only ever going to go
Bentley canteen.
Yeah, but the hides are only ever going to go to waste anyway, so they are still using a byproduct. They don't have a Bentley only forest that's making their dashboards. Those, you know, they've got deals with timber merchants. The timber, you know, it might be going for paper, it might be going for furniture, and they're using a very thin veneer. So that's their argument. Kia's is, we've got enough plastic in the world already, and we can build cars without using too much of it. And I think by launching on the EV9, which is obviously a big expensive, it's still a lot of money, 75 grand, let's not beat about the bush on that. If they can sort of iron it all out in this, then who's to say that the next Picanto won't have a fully recycled interior for a considerably lower price? And I think that is a vibe that we can agree is a good thing. So, an interesting car, not something that's going to live long in the memory as a drive, but as a piece of design and family engineering, it's clever, because and very good seats in it.
Yeah, and every year we talk, you know, it's been decades since we said the Koreans are coming. I mean, they arrived a long time ago, but each year they move the game on. So whether it's Hyundai or Kia, really just pushing the boundaries into new areas and making it stick.
Yeah, I mean, we should say this thing looks awesome. Like, it's such a cool, confident piece of design. It's so blocky and bluff and square. And the very fact that we're even offering it up as a possibility that someone might want a 3-row, 7-seat premium Kia SUV when, you know, people were snorting at Sportages 10 years ago. And now this is, you know, it's a viable thing, and I'll be really, really interested to see how it goes down. But as a family car, we like cars that are brave, cars that take risks, and the EV9 does that, so it got the award.
Yeah, as does this one. The car we're most looking forward to driving in 2024 is the Ford Mustang GTD. No, it's not a high-performance diesel variant.
Yeah, they're going to give it a remap, and it's going to be rolling coal.
Plenty of talk. No, it's this is the absolutely bonkers. Ford just basically took their GT3 race car, removed all regulations. It is essentially a GT3 RS or an AMG GT Black Series rival, based on the Ford Mustang. So massive downforce, you know, completely redone suspension. I think about 800 horsepower from the sort of a pumped up engine from the Shelby GT500,
yeah,
800 horsepower or something.
Every now and again they do this, don't they, the Americans? They kind of let the Europeans have their fun with their downforce monsters. Dodge did it a while ago with that Viper ACR. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
They were kind of like, those are cute, look at this. And they've really, really...
more. You know,
they've turned the volume knob off until it's come off in their hand, haven't they? It's absolutely ridiculous. So that is... yeah, whoever gets to go and drive that next year better be training their neck now.
And buy some decent earplugs.
Mm.
Performance car of the year, Honda Civic Type R.
The winner of Speed Week.
The winner of Speed Week. So this is the one award where we're drawing up our big list of award winners. This is the one that gets us going.
The first name on the team sheet.
The first name. Here we go.
First pick.
The winner of Speed Week. So again, go back, listen to our two-part Speed Week special podcast, and you'll hear all about how brilliant the Honda Civic Type R is and why it wins Performance Car of the Year. Let's spend a bit more time on this next one, though. So innovation of the year goes to Koenigsegg CC850 Engage Shift System.
So this is not for the whole car.
No.
This is an award purely for the gearbox mechanism.
Yes.
Are you brainy enough to explain how this works? This is my fear.
Right, I just need to stretch off slightly. No, so just to paint a sort of broader picture. This is... the Koenigsegg CC850 is it's based on the Jesko supercar, but it's much more, it's retro styling. It's to
it's an homage to the CC, the original Koenigsegg, isn't it?
Exactly.
From, God, that makes me feel old. Do you remember when that was on
yeah.
Top Gear and the Stig span it? It wasn't the first one that went...
And they put a wing on the back.
Yeah. No, that was the CCX. This is before that. There was the CC and there was a shot of the Stig. He span it across the line. He literally went backwards across the line when he did the lap time. But it's, yeah, this is the OG Koenigsegg from 2003 when no one had heard of them. And all of a sudden it was like, have you seen that Sweden's got a car that's got more power than the McLaren F1?
Yeah.
Which at the time was still the fastest car in the world.
Wow.
It was, yeah, so this is them going, look how far we've come. We're now going to take our newest type of car and drape a sort of homage to that body on it.
Exactly. And then to keep the retro vibes running in a way that only Christian von Koenigsegg can, he's already got a furiously complicated in-house designed gearbox on the Jesko, which is a 9-speed, he calls it the light speed automatic transmission. And then this has a manual gearbox. Now, we've been calling it a simulated manual gearbox because on one level it is. It's basically a shift-by-wire system and a clutch-by-wire system to control the gears on this light speed automatic transmission, which he claims, once it's finished, will feel exactly like a real manual gearbox. So, for example, if you bring the clutch up too quickly, you'll stall. You know, you can slip the clutch. You can't put the gearbox into a lower gear if the revs are too high. Everything, every sort
can't
of foible,
money shift it.
Yeah, every foible of a real manual gearbox has been built in.
But if you're not in the mood, the idea is that you can just leave it alone and it's then the world's smoothest, quickest automatic.
You just put it into automatic.
And does it have paddles behind the steering wheel so you can have like best of all worlds? Can you
no.
shift on the paddles?
I don't believe it does actually. You've caught me off guard there.
Because I'm just looking at it, we should explain. So when you got on this Koenigsegg, you've had an early drive in the prototype. So it wasn't like a flat out drive, but you were just kind of helping sense check the gearbox, I guess.
Exactly.
What do you see when you look down in between the seats? What are you looking at? Is it something that you recognise as a gear lever?
Not really. You see an exposed mechanism through the open gate of the manual shifter. It's not exactly clear what you're looking at, but what it actually is precision electronics controlling clutches rather than precision electronic controlling clutches from the clutch pedal rather than hydraulic fluid.
Drive-by-wire manual gearbox.
Exactly. And then precision electronics also controlling the clutches when you move the gear stick around. Now, I shall attempt. Are you ready? Okay.
Let's have
it. So this light-speed auto transmission, it's a bit like a derailleur on your bike.
I didn't know you spoke French.
Derailleur. So you have two shafts with three gears on each one. Each gear has a clutch on it. You also have a seventh clutch for your reverse gear, but let's leave that to one side at the moment. So you have two shafts here. So any combination of these three gears can produce a ratio. So 3 times 3, you have 9 ratios in total. But the really clever thing about it is you can leap from, you close a clutch on the first shaft to pick one of those three gears. You then close a clutch on the second shaft to select one of those three gears, giving you your ratio. It means you can jump from any ratio to any other.
The mountain bike analogy is really helpful here because I can remember sort of looking down while pedaling and think, okay, I can shift up on the front cog and leave the back one alone, or I can do the opposite and I can make it easier for myself as I go along. What I loved there was you went from air shifting to describe shifting to air shafting and using your fingers to sort of describe
not
where the
first time.
Clutches are. But it just goes to show
I haven't finished.
So
now that you understand how the auto box works, basically with this, so say you go to select first gear, so foot down on the clutch, all 7 clutches are open.
Right.
Okay. So nothing's happening. You know, you're in neutral.
Yes.
You move the gear shift towards the first slot on the gearbox.
Yep.
The corresponding clutch to the gear on the first shaft engages, but still you're in neutral. No power is being sent to the axles. And then as you lift your foot on the clutch, on the clutch pedal, the clutch on the second shaft starts to engage.
And then have they engineered in like a bite point feel? So you can sort of feel that step as the gear bites.
Yes. So the version that I drove
on sort of 17 Mile Road in Monterey when I was over there for Car Week was quite an early prototype. I just wanted to get a feel for the system, and yeah, it's a manual. You put a clutch down, you select your gear, you lift the clutch up, you balance it on the throttle. What wasn't on that version was the force feedback. So exactly what you're talking about.
They're still going to do that.
Yeah, the force feedback on the clutch, that little nibble when you find your biting point. Like playing a computer game, you know, your steering wheel for Gran Turismo, the way it's
force feedback.
Exactly. That's what it is.
I mean, the amount of engineering man hours and the electronic wizardry that's going into keeping the manual gearbox alive. That's why this is the Top Gear innovation of the year, isn't it? Because this isn't making the car faster.
Yeah.
It's not making the car lap a track
yeah.
more efficiently. It's preserving the feel of the manual gearbox in a car with a gearbox like no other. I mean, I take my hat off where I'm wearing one.
But the best thing is, and this is, I think, what marks out an engineering genius, is he hasn't done it just for the kudos of going, hey, looks and feels like a manual, and I did it a very complicated way because I can.
Mm.
You know, normally, if you wanted to convert a supercar, a hypercar to manual, you'd find a supplier who made a very robust manual gearbox, you'd bolt it in, you'd rehomologate the car, and you'd be done. But here he said, no, you would lose all the benefits. So one of the benefits of this light speed automatic transmission is you have no flywheel on the engine. And that's why it revs like a superbike on steroids. I think there was a lot of chatter around the T50 video that Gordon Murray claims 52,000 RPM per second on the 4-litre
quite
Cosworth
a sharp
V12,
throttle on that one.
Which is decent.
It's a bit
level.
Lively.
So that's essentially how quickly the engine would rev. If you're in neutral and you blip the throttle, that's how quickly. I think it's about something like 42,000 on this engine.
Diesel in comparison.
Yeah, I mean, he barely responds. Mm. But he didn't want to lose that no flywheel, super revy character, so he wanted to keep the thing. You also wouldn't have the option of an auto mode.
Yeah.
And you also, he'd have to completely rehomologate the car. So this is a piece of technology that you just slap on top. Mm. And if you can prove it works, away you go. And of course, he can add this to other cars if he wants. You know, will we see a Gemera with one of these on it? Why not?
Of course,
You know.
I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because Toyota at the moment are talking about how they're engineering a manual transmission for electric cars that they're going to make optionally in future. And then meanwhile, Koenigsegg are engineering an automatic gearbox, the world's most advanced automatic gearbox that you can also use as an open gate manual. I think it's just tremendous. I can't wait for the CC850 to be finished so we can give it a
exactly.
Proper,
so I should say,
thrashing.
That it's not an on the limit road test of the CC850, which is a car we're very excited about.
Mm.
That will come later. This was just a first little taster to help us understand how this piece of technology works.
Yeah, so if you want to know your shifts from your shafts, check out the mag. Moving very, very swiftly on to our Eco Warrior of the Year.
Now,
this is interesting, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, Volvo EX30. So Ollie is very keen to point out that this car has not been awarded.
It's not crossover of the year.
No.
It's not
small family car of the year.
No, there's a very specific aspect of this car's creation that we are appraising here, and this is the seriousness with which Volvo, like with Polestar, its all electric offshoot, is taking the electric car's dirty secret, isn't it? The fact that they are a nightmare environmentally to produce, and you know the whole thing of but don't you have to drive them 100,000 miles before they've done better for the planet than the electric car would. So the whole point about the EX30 is the everything, the mining, the materials, the manufacture, everything about it is designed to be as low impact as possible. And as a result, and this is the other thing, is they're publishing all their figures.
Yeah.
They're showing they're working, like I was taught to when I was terrible at maths.
Yeah.
And so
we should say this is for the £34,000 base model.
Yes.
Including its battery. CO2 footprint for mining, materials, refining and manufacture is 18 tons of CO2.
Which is... still feels like a lot.
Still feels like
tons,
a lot. But
then you need some context.
Yeah, so you compare that to Volvo's smallest petrol car, which is the XC40, and that's 16 tons to
produce. You're 2 tons worse off by buying the EV.
Yep.
But when it arrives at your door.
But that gap is a lot closer than it is, I should say, for pretty much every other manufacturer.
Yes.
So because you've got
a lower gap there, then it's quicker for you to catch up and overtake the petrol version once you're driving it around. So 8,000, if you drive 8,000 miles a year in this EX30, within 2.5 years, it will be better off for the environment.
Yeah, and we should say that those 8,000 miles, this has come from, Top Gear Big Brain Paul Horrell.
Yeah.
He's worked this out using real-world fuel figures for what, you know, the MPG that you would actually expect in an XC40, not the pie-in-the-sky ones that they give you in the brochure.
And the UK electricity mix.
Exactly, the UK electricity mix of, you know, how often we're solar and how often we're wind and how often we're coal-powered electricity here. So it's a real-world 8,000 miles a year, then...
Yeah.
So it's going to take you, what was it, two and a half years?
Yeah. Two and a half years and you'll be better off.
Yeah. It's within your finance agreement, isn't it? But before the end of your standard PCP, you're going to be better off than you would have been. Now, on its own, this is not going to, you know, change the climate, but what it is it just shows how seriously car manufacturers have got to take it. It's no good just saying, oh, it's all right, our range is fully electric now, job done. You've got to completely reapproach how you're building the car, how you're shipping the car to the customer, what you're building it out of, how you're powering that factory, the whole thing. It's very holistic. And it's going to be an arms race in future, and it's no good. I think this is the whole argument with the Chinese cars coming, isn't it? It's all very well, get these Chinese EVs, they're so much cheaper, fantastic. Mm-hmm. But where's the power coming from that's building them, and how sustainably is it being done? These are important questions, and that's why we felt it was only right that Top Gear recognised the effort that Volvo went to. But I would just point out, I've just got a slight annoyance with the EX30, which I think looks like a tremendous piece of design. It's beautifully packaged inside to be this kind of pared back but still very Higa for like well-being.
I haven't
done my Swedish Duolingo today, but it's a nice piece of design, and apparently, by all accounts, it drives beautifully as well. But they've done a Tesla inside, and they've got rid of all the buttons. There's no speedo display. It's all in the touchscreen. If you want to put the fog light on, you've got to go in the touchscreen. If you want to adjust the mirrors.
You love that, don't you?
Yeah, I think it's brilliant that when I can't see where I'm going because of mist, I have to play on an iPad. And this coming from the car company that literally invented the seatbelt and then gave it away for free for the greater good to save millions of lives, which proudly tells everyone that no one's ever died in an XC90. I think it's a little bit hypocritical to then make your car difficult to drive for the sake of minimalist design. So Volvo, well done on how you've produced this car, but next time could you put like 0.5 gram of CO2 on the total and give us some buttons?
Because they do claim that it's a eco decision, right? If you just have a screen,
it eases the manufacturing.
If you don't have to make buttons, it makes everything easy.
So there we go. Let's have some recycled wood buttons. But otherwise, I think the EX30 is a very, very interesting car. It'll be interesting to see how they take that across the range.
Cool. All right, next one is Lifetime Achievement Award, and it goes to a bloke called Adrian Newey.
What a monster of motorsport achievement.
Now, I just want to, just before we delve into this a little bit more, some context around why we've chosen Adrian Newey. So you might have heard that he's actually working on a track-only hypercar, a Red Bull-branded track-only hypercar called the RB17.
That's right.
There's a good chance we're going to see that in 2024. It's obviously going to be completely bonkers. That was on some scrappy planning document I've got somewhere, and we thought, oh yeah, no, maybe we could get hold of that and maybe shoot it for awards. The timing didn't work out, but then Adrian was suddenly on our radar, and it got us thinking, well, this man is a titan of the sport.
He's still at the top of his game.
Absolutely.
What's fascinating is when someone's at the height of their powers. Often, especially in sport, you kind of almost don't recognise that someone's a goat until perhaps, you know, that they're slightly over the hill and you realise that you're on the downslope and that you've seen the greatest of them, and you have to be at a real ultimate, like a Messi or a Federer, to sort of know that you're that great in your own time, I guess. But Newey is, at the time of recording this, the latest Formula One car he's designed, the RB19, has just won the Vegas Grand Prix. It's won 19 out of 20 races in the longest Formula One season of all time. It is just beyond consistent, and it's almost as much as a Formula One fan would be like, thank goodness that Ferrari nicked that race off them, it's almost a pity that he can't turn around and go, he designed an unbeatable car. But he's come about as close as it's possible to get. And I think you just have to, as much as it's not the ultimate in kind of racing excitement, you have to take your hat off to the perfection.
Yeah.
And so much of that has come from, you know, yes, it's the engine, yes, it's the team, the pit stops, and the drivers as well. Mm. But wow, his leadership of that aero department is now beyond legend, isn't it? He's the guy. So what would Ferrari pay to poach him, or McLaren, or Aston Martin?
Yeah.
You imagine?
Yeah. Crazy. So Jason Barlow's done a fantastic interview. Went to go and see him at the Red Bull Performance Centre and sat down face to face with Adrian, just sort of picked his brains, really. There's just a lovely, lots of good stuff in here. But specifically on the RB19, Jason asks him, did it surprise him, you know, how dominant it's been? And he says, yeah, it was a surprise, complete surprise. For the 22 season, we had the biggest regulation change since 83 on the chassis side in terms of going back to Venturi cars. So he thought, as they headed into the second year with no regulation change over the winter and us running what is in effect an evolution car, that our advantage would be diminished, if not eradicated. And clearly that's not how it panned out. Modest.
I love that British understatement is incredibly charming,
that's
isn't
not
it?
How it panned out.
Yeah, but the fact that he talks about it gives hope for any of us, anyone who's listening, he's like, oh, I hate going to school and I'm rubbish at it and I don't really fit in. Like, he talks about being an outcast at school and about not really, you know, kind of finding his comfort zone, you know, and then, you know, look where he's ended up now. Like, you know, found something that he was passionate about and he pursued it doggedly. And, you know, we shouldn't just forget as well that it's not just with the Verstappen, the latest era of cars. He also designed all of Vettel's. You know, he won four championships on the spin, driving Adrian Newey's cars. And before that, he was at McLaren. He was successful. And then, you know, going right back to Leighton House, he's always had this way of, people talk about the fact that he can see the air. That there's something about him that he can just understand and interpret. Not that kind of air.
Oh, sorry.
It's just, yeah, beyond anyone else. And I think he's someone that, as much as kind of we, I guess, in car circles and motorsport circles revere him, he's probably a bit of an unsung hero as a British sportsman. I hope he gets recognised wider.
Well, he's now sung.
It's now the Top Gear Award, stop two, Sports Personality of the Year.
And I think, I'm pretty sure this will be the greatest moment in his career, winning this Top Gear Lifetime Achievement.
His cars have won over 200 Formula One Grand Prix. But you reckon?
Yeah,
it was shaking hands with you in Shepherd's Bush. That was the pinnacle. Didn't get better than this.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lovely, just to round off the Adrian Newey chat. So the final question Jason asks him is lovely. So you've worked with some of the greatest drivers in motorsport. Is there one underlying characteristic that strikes you as most important? Selfishness.
I love that. I love that he didn't go, oh, dedication, teamwork. No, selfishness. Fantastic.
So focused, he says, is probably a better word. Shutting out all other things in life when you're on the zone. And then he says the other thing is spare mental capacity. So lots and lots of drivers are quick. If you've made it to F1, you're quick. And you can drive very quickly for a period of time. But, and this is the quote now, you know that every available neuron is going into the process. There's nothing left to think about how the race is unfolding, to adjust the car, manage the tyres. Being able to do that is what marks out the world champion. So driving at the absolute pinnacle pace and still having a little bit of brain power left to think about what you're going to have for dinner. That is the key.
So what were you saying?
Sorry, I was just reading something.
I ran out of mental capacity. It's not as easy as it looks, is it? So
lovely.
I love that, and I think that the insinuation that you're only using 10% of your brain to drive a Formula One car, and then the rest of it should be thinking on racecraft, just blows my tiny mind.
My mind that they can still look down and adjust the dials on the wheel.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know,
and still think of banter for the team radio. It seems that Max Verstappen spends more time thinking of zingers to call his race engineer than he does absolutely dominating the field.
Cool. All right, so last one, car of the year. The big
cue award. The fanfare and that echo reverb again. Car of the year.
Brittany, break out the sound effects. We want drum rolls, we want brass bands and fireworks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Get some fireworks, please. Thanks. Order them up.
Nothing says car of the year like Catherine wheels.
Yes, beautiful. they just make a sort of annoying kind of whistling noise. It's Catherine wheels.
We've gone really off topic again.
I think big rockets. We want big... All right.
And the Top Gear car of the year goes to...
the Hyundai Ioniq 5N.
Ooh, now then. We were talking about synthesized gear shifts earlier. This car is synthesized everything.
This is synthesized everything.
But
in fact, doesn't come with wheels. You just sit in it in your driveway.
It's got pixels.
And the windscreen is just a sort of wraparound IMAX screen. No, so...
I think this could be a controversial one, but let's make our argument and we'll see what the listeners say in the comments on Spotify.
Yeah, so we drove this car exclusively at Speed Week again. So we had one in Sweden.
Mm.
We only drove it on track. We did have a very small go on the road.
Because it was a pre-production prototype with all sorts of caveats attached to it. But we weren't going to give up that easily. Oh, no.
No.
We wanted it on the road.
So we drove it on track. Go and have a look on YouTube. I made a video about it. Really impressive. Playing with all the gadgets and gizmos and drift modes and simulated paddle shift gearbox that it's got. It is, by the way, an electric car, if you don't know, with the Ioniq 5N. Single speed, electric car, four-wheel drive, up to 641 horsepower.
It looks like a great big hot hatch. It's actually the size of a Range Rover Evoque, but they have thrown the digital kitchen sink at it to make what's basically a big electric crossover give you the hot hatch giggles.
Yeah, yeah, and unashamedly copying the things that, you know, get us all fizzy from a combustion engine hot hatch. So let's just put a pin in that for now. So we'd driven it on track. We knew if a car was going to win Car of the Year, we had an inkling that this was a bit of a game changer, this car. So we posted Paul Horrell off to South Korea.
First class.
Second class. And
recorded delivery, Paul Horrell to Seoul.
To Seoul, to go on a proper Korean road trip. So he picked the car up in Seoul and went off to drive as many different types of roads in Korea. There's some great driving roads in South Korea.
Yeah, a bit of a undiscovered paradise for fun driving, isn't it?
And the sort of shtick for the feature was a bit like a computer game, because this car, as we've already explained, is so synthesized. So level one was trying to negotiate the traffic in Seoul. Level two was a kind of winding valley road. Level three was up a mountain pass. Level four was along the coast, etc., etc. So we ticked all these boxes, and a bit like you in the Rolls Spectre, you know, made the call. Hope Horrell likes it too. Yeah, no, he did like it.
Top Gear's Mr. Second Opinion.
Mr. Second.
But it won him over, and he's a different generation to us, isn't he? And he's not perhaps so up on his computer game synthetics.
Well, he's definitely an EV advocate. Mm. So, you know, he had that going in its favour. But equally, he is the first one to call out superfluous... But equally, he's the first one to call out superfluous gimmicks.
Oh,
on a car.
I don't remember him going gaga for Tesla's karaoke mode somehow.
Although he was quite partial to the fart mode, which...
That's what he blamed it on. Anyway.
Right. So the Ioniq 5N. Basically, what they've done is if you were sitting around a boardroom and somebody said, hey, why don't we just try and pretend, use all this, the possibilities around electronics, to make it feel like hot hatches. People love the traditional front-engined, fizzy hot hatch. Let's see if we
can
recreate it.
They're like pops and bangs and surges. And to give you an idea of just the kind of levels they've gone to here, not only is there a rev counter in one of the modes in the Ioniq 5N, there's a rev counter on the screen, isn't there?
Hmm.
But when you blip it, the revs, when they settle back down, so the needle, if you like, the needle wobbles like it does in an old 90s hot hatch. It doesn't just sit at, like, you know, 750 RPM or whatever they've chosen. It murmurs about to give you the idea that the car's kind of getting restless and that the needle's a bit poorly calibrated. I mean, that's, someone sat and coded that.
Yeah.
Someone's had to teach it to do that. And it's the same with, like you say, about, you know, you can hit the rev limiter in it. Rev limiter in what? It's got an electric motor. But they've gone to these lengths to go, okay, look, if you want a sensible electric car, we'll sell you plenty of those. But there are people out there who aren't willing to get rid of everything in the name of raw speed. And that's what the 5N does. Mm-hmm. But it's how convincingly it does all this, which is what's won us over.
A good example here is fake noise. As a principle, fake noise is not a good thing.
Oh, right? You do it in an M car and the forums are frothing.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, you want real noise. I mean, Tesla, commendably, they don't do any noises. It's just like, let's celebrate the noise that an electric car makes. You know, I like that. That's a solid philosophy. But I think people just haven't done fake noise very well yet. This car does it, I think, the most convincingly. It's not. I'm not saying it makes the best noise. It just responds the most accurately to your to your throttle inputs. And if you're in this sort of fake paddle shift gearbox mode, the way that it interrupts the torques on an upshift, it blips it on a downshift. It's all really convincing, and there comes a point where you go, I know it's fake. At no point do I not know that this is a fake soundtrack being pumped in. But it really helps me. It helps me know how fast I'm going. It's actually more fun. I did a lap in Sweden in just single ratio wall of torque mode.
Yeah, it's
and
then
to drive, with the pedal.
It?
Yeah, it's harder to drive.
Because you don't sort of know where you are. And if it does start to kind of oversteer on you, you can't kind of, you haven't got that audible clue that you know, as the engine rev spike and it's about to go sideways. Can I do a Paul Horrell quote?
Yes.
I quote live from the magazine. Okay, here's what Paul said about the noise. Count his you can tell what's on his playlist recently. The engine, in inverted commas, goes from a deep determined Stormzy through a moderately angry Sam Fender to a full screaming John Bon Jovi. There you go. I mean, pop culture references are go-go in
it's
the
normally
Arctic
Jason fiber. Barlow that has the obscure music.
Well,
references.
He's met them all.
Yeah.
But Horrell's just listening to them.
No, it's a fantastic story that confirms what we suspected from our first go on track. And just a word on why it's Car of the Year. So, in all honesty, there's a number of cars that you could make an argument for here. You know, Gordon Murray T50, that is a landmark supercar, hypercar.
Yeah, we're calling it the greatest of all time.
The greatest of all time. And yet, you know, it's £2.5 million.
You make it 100 of something and they're £2.5 million a pop. It's difficult to say that's really going to change cars for lots of people around the world. I think what the Arnic 5N's doing is, if this works, you know, if it's obviously getting the feedback that they want it to, but then if it gets the sales and the feedback from the customers, good ideas get copied, and this could be a whole new avenue for electric cars to explore and stay fun and be interactive, and it's a cause for hope.
Yes, hope, and that's what I think. And I think this is just one way of doing it. Mm. You know, there are infinite possibilities with electricity and software. If you've got a motor on each wheel, you know, literally, you can make a car do anything if you're clever enough as a programmer. So there are ideas that are going to come down the line that we can't even fathom right now. And I know pretty much every manufacturer of fast cars will be trying to cook up things that make their cars interesting and engaging in ways that we haven't seen.
I bet there's quite a few car makers who absolutely will not admit to it, who are getting their hands on these 5Ns, and they're going to be ripping them to bits in their bunkers somewhere to figure out, you know, how have they made this 2.2 ton crossover that, as Horrell says, feels like it sheds half a ton. When you do, you know, as long as you're in the right modes and stuff, it really can disguise its weight well. It can feel playful. It can be a laugh. It can do the bullet train thing in a straight line if you want.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are going to be going, hang on, how have they done this? How have they, as you say, got the speaker noise to agree with the throttle pedal so you don't have that horrible kind of lag that a Bath 500E that turned up on Speedweek did, and it sounded like, you know, it had a CVT being driven, you know, down a dial-up connection. It just sort of didn't work. This does. And there'll be a lot of people not only ripping the engineering, the sort of bits of metal apart, but also plugging into the diagnostics box.
Just
and
plug
going,
a laptop in, don't you?
Exactly, yeah. And going, right, let's just download this thing's
brain. Why are you ripping it apart? Are you just yes. It all comes up
just
on the
USB
screen.
It.
Anyway, so look, massive congratulations to Ioniq 5N.
And to Hyundai, because again, their consistency, they were manufacturer of the year not so long ago.
I20N 2 years ago, 2021 was
yes, that was car, that was performance car of the year and car
and
of
car
the year.
But a very different type of car, but that's probably quite an interesting comparison, isn't it?
That, yeah, it's a
sort of
church.
A back to basic, simple, raw, old school hot hatch.
Yeah. I still think there'll be people out there going, no, I couldn't drive a car that had a fake rev count and a fake gear shift. And I just say, I defy someone to try that and not be slightly won over by it, even despite yourself. It's kind of like, you know, I don't like Taylor Swift, and then you go, well, quite a lot of bangers on the new album though, aren't there? It's
well,
just,
you heard it here first.
It brings people round, and I think you'd have to be a very, very ardent cynic not to enjoy anything about that car. And that's what makes it very, very interesting.
So this is the point of the pod where we'd normally have a quiz.
But there's only two of us and I normally do the questions. So that's basically an interview, isn't it?
Yeah,
isn't it? If I just ask you some questions and you answer them.
Yeah, 2 out of 10.
Yeah, if you get them all wrong, it's quite embarrassing.
It doesn't work like that.
So we'll have to pause the quiz on this edition.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll keep it pure awards.
At least we'll still be on speaking terms after.
So let's, why don't we use this time to just shamelessly plug everything that's going on in the Top Gear universe. I think I've done awards, you know, consume it how you will. This podcast, video on YouTube, buy a magazine, go on topgear.com, follow all our social media channels, check us out on Apple News, Apple News Plus, if you've got that.
Mm.
All these options are available to you, but what else is going on?
Well, there's also stuff, you know, stuff that's not even been in the awards, you know, meanwhile kind of normal Top Gear life rumbles on. So if you want to see a super detailed walk around of Caterham's new electric sports car, that's gone live on the YouTube channel. I've been to Estoril to drive the new McLaren that looks like the old one, but it's a bit good, the new McLaren 750S.
You got the name right.
Yeah, as I didn't in the video, go and watch the intro to see that. What else has been going on?
Quite a bit, really. So there's the Gordon Murray T50 video.
Oh, you've got to go and see that film.
And then our really shiny, ambitious, big new US-focused YouTube series has gone live. So it's called TG2 Cars and Stripes, Episode 1, presented by myself and Jethro Bovingdon, is live on the YouTube channel. Go and check it out. It's a lot of fun. It features the first episode, Travis Pastrana's 862 horsepower Subaru Huckster, the family Huckster.
Yeah, Jethro's getting a heck of a driving lesson from the man himself, Mr. Yeah. Pastrana.
Yeah, it didn't
very,
look
very
like
cool.
The driving lessons I used to get, but hey ho.
Oh, it's just really annoying how easily Jethro picked that up. Not even picked it up. It's just drift around there, just do a reverse entry. Oh, like that. Yeah, good job.
I also drive just quite a sensible car, actually. It's the 4-ton, 1,000 horsepower Hummer EV.
Are you now the
Just a family electric car.
The Top Gear ridiculous electric pickup truck correspondent, because you've driven the Cybertruck that you're not allowed to talk about, and the Hummer, which everyone would rather you didn't.
And the Ford F-150 Lightning.
Of course, yeah.
Yes, I am.
Jack's hillbilly in chief.
Yes. So check out TG2. One episode a week, Sundays, 4 p.m. So by the time you listen to this, there should be a number out there and you can work your way back through them and enjoy
nice
them all.
Nice long form. Get your TG telly fix.
Yeah. Oh, one more thing.
One more thing.
One more thing. We've got to tell you about the final award because it comes at the end of the magazine. So Retro Hero of the Year is the little car company's Tamiya Wild One Max. Now, if you haven't heard about this, this is sensational. It's a remote control car from the 1980s that has been inflated to life size. You can actually fit two adults in it. It's an electric off-road buggy. Anyone who's an 80s kid is just maximum nostalgia. And we're the first people to actually drive it. So Jason Barlow went to go and have a go in it on a very muddy rally school somewhere in Oxfordshire. You can read the full story in the mag and go to YouTube and watch the video of Jason getting very muddy and going very, very sideways and basically reliving a misspent youth.
I mean, I'm not an 80s kid, but it made me want one.
Yes, it's absolutely sensational. And we forgot to say, if you're listening on Spotify, then please make use of the functionality below where you can comment and get involved.
Get involved.
Get involved. And let us know which of the award winners that we talked about in this podcast you would make Car of the Year. Because I think, as we said, any number of them could have got the nod. We went with the Ioniq 5N for its the way that it makes.
I wonder how many people are going to vote for the Cybertruck. I'll be interested to see. So, yeah, get your votes in.
Or T50. Ooh. Or Spectre. I mean, you called it the best car in the world.
Let's not do this again.
Thank you for listening to the Top Gear Magazine podcast. Hope you enjoyed that. And don't forget to subscribe, to leave us a review, to leave us a star rating.
But also check out what is in the rest of the feed, because as well as interviews, we've got our monthly behind the curtain look into the issues that we make. And also, there's some new audio tidbits coming. So, like Jack says, subscribe.